what are the skills that are required moving forward? What are the skills that we need to survive, but also thrive in this now, hopefully post-pandemic phase? And I think that those soft skills are where it's at. Leadership is about engaging, communicating, supporting, making connections with other people, and being resilient, being able to collaborate. Those key skills are now going to really come to the fore. And I think what we know from neuroscience, psychology, behavioral science, we can start putting some proper processes into place of how we can develop that and build on those skills.
Welcome to the HR L&D podcast with your host, Nick Day, CEO and founder of JGA Recruitment, specialist HR recruiters. Tuning into the HR L&D podcast will help you to discover strategic growth concepts, leadership development strategies, and the values and behaviours that drive organisational change and success. Together, let's empower our workforces, diversify our thinking, and achieve significant HR success.
Hello and welcome to the HR L&D podcast. Today I'm joined by Simon Ashton, Head of Learning and Development at Phoenix Leaders. Now, Simon is a business psychologist, trainer and certified coach with over 15 years experience in learning and development. At Phoenix Leaders, Simon works with clients across a broad range of sectors to solve their L&D issues by applying the most up-to-date research from the fields of neuroscience, something we're going to find out an awful lot more about today, psychology, anthropology, and social sciences. With both an academic and professional background in behavioural sciences, Simon helps organisations to gain a better understanding of how people act, think, and feel to achieve tangible business outcomes. And I'm really excited to welcome him to the HR&D podcast today. He's got a wealth of knowledge in the world of neuroscience, and in particular, how it can help HR, payroll, and learning and development professionals. Now, prior to joining Phoenix Leaders, Simon headed up his own L&D consultancy, and he has previously held a number of roles in the executive search field. He also holds an MSc in business psychology and is accredited by the British Psychological Society as a psychometric assessment practitioner. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this podcast all about how neuroscience can help us all become better leaders for the future. Enjoy.
I spent a vast majority of my career working within the recruitment sector and search and selection, probably 15 years supporting retail, hospitality, sales, service industries, and then was always fascinated with human behaviour and why do people make the decisions they make, particularly if you're going to move careers, if you're joining an organisation, what motivates you to make that move. And then, and so diverted into study and went to complete a master's in business psychology, and that just exploded my mind even further into actually I just want to get into this so much deeper, and has now gravitated more towards learning and development training, learning transfer. And so where I am currently, Phoenix Leaders, a training provider, training consultancy, where as Nick already said, we help leaders, managers, predominantly within the softer skills, human skills, 21st century skills. But it's very much about using evidence-based psychology, neuroscience, behavioral science to make sure that we're maybe dispelling some of the myths that are out there in regards to what is best practice and how organizations are engaging with their members, their teams, how they're helping them develop, how we're motivating them, and using the research from psychology, neuroscience, etc., to maybe present a different way of doing that and getting and improving and helping organizations perform better. So that's where I am currently.
Super, fantastic. I'm desperate to get into the question of neuroscience and in particular how we can use that to gain a deeper understanding of how we can improve our leadership skills. But I wonder if you could just position what neuroscience is for the listener group. For some it might be obvious, for some it may not be, but also how it relates to psychology, and just want to give us a bit of a platform, if you like, to start the discussion by just defining what those terms mean in a little bit more context before we jump into the deeper stuff, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, the neuroscience is the study, the research into the brain and the nervous system, and therefore that impacts not just in terms of cognitive emotional process, but also physiological process. How does the brain then interact with the body as a whole? And it is very much a system. So neuroscience considers the brain and the nervous system, whereas psychology is around the theory of mind, let's say, and understanding actually how do we think, how do we engage with the world, where does personality fit into that, where does motivation fit into that. So two very big subject matters, two very big areas of research. And I think where psychology has very much been embedded within leadership development for a number of years, neuroscience is relatively new as a field of study and a field of research. I am not a neuroscientist. I am a practitioner of neuroscience research. But I think at 20 years old in terms of neuroscience, that is new, that is young in comparison to psychology. And therefore, what we're finding and what's being presented in the field of neuroscience is fascinating and how it can be applied. I think what we've got to be careful of as well, though, is that one piece of research doesn't mean, therefore, that is taken as granted and that is a given. But I must say, some of the information around neuroscience, particularly around threat and reward, how the brain responds to perceived threat in terms of how do we then turn into survival mode and how do we become most productive and best productive? How does the brain take stimuli and how do we interact with our environment and other people? I think that's shining a light on things that maybe haven't seen before.
Fantastic. I think that's given us a really good overview. And it's worth mentioning, if you heard my introduction as well, of course, you're coming from the learning and development side of this, and you have had your own L&D consultancy. You're very much an HR and L&D practitioner with experience and a real interest in the research into neuroscience, which is something we're going to delve into a little bit more deeper now. And I guess my first question would be then, how can we begin to gain a deeper understanding of emotional responses to help improve our leadership skills?
We know emotion impacts every single thing that we do. I think we've, for many years, we've always looked at, we leave emotions at home or outside of the workplace, and that we believe that the human being is a very logical, very analytical, very methodical planner, thinker, doer. But actually what we've recognized through the research and over time is that emotions sit in every single aspect of where we're at. And I think for me, one of the key factors where we're at currently is, I think emotional intelligence, as we know, we're still in the pandemic, we're starting to move to a different phase right now. But I believe that words and phrases and terms such as emotional intelligence are being heard, being talked about, being engaged with so much more. But I think that also emotional response, we're under a lot of pressure. Everyone's under a huge amount of stress right now, be that still balancing childcare and working environment, still being apart from loved ones. We've still got the budget constraints, the managing of budgets. We've still got sales targets to achieve. We've still got difficult decisions to make. And therefore, how do we use and how do we engage with our emotions to be able to manage this situation is massively important. So I think we need to turn away from the fact that we're not just robots who can be logical and methodical and analytical. We are human beings who are overtaken and maybe react to our emotional responses every minute of every day. And the more that we can get the neuroscience and open neuroscience into that, I think the better for leaders and managers, because we're in a knowledge age, and I think the more knowledge we can consume about how we think, feel, behave, act is massively important.
Sure. And are there tips or are there triggers we should look out for to help us gain a better understanding if we are starting to follow an emotional response that perhaps isn't going to benefit us in the way that it could? Are there things that we should be more inwardly aware of?
So self-awareness is a starting point within terms of emotional response and emotional intelligence, understanding what triggers us at certain situations. What is it? Which colleagues, which pieces of work? What's the deadline around understanding actually what is it that makes me feel? And I think makes me feel, I think is a really good point to make, is that we feel it physiologically. You feel a tense jaw, you feel a tense shoulder, you feel yourself probably breathing more shallowly than you would do normally. There's lots of physiological signs when you know you're under pressure and you're having an emotional response, but we forget as human beings that those are happening, and we sort of block them out. So one of the key factors, one of the first things that I advise anybody to do is getting a grip of the physiological response. And that would a natural, normal thing is breathing. We do that all the time. We breathe every minute of every day. But I think that we forget that if we're doing shallow breathing, we're not getting enough oxygen to our more logical and thinking parts of the brain. So just taking that step, just to engage with, first of all, I'm sensing this trigger, I'm sensing the physiological response, and then getting that physical response under control by engaging some slower, deeper breathing. It sounds really basic, but it works. It works in mindfulness techniques. It works in meditation. That's what it's all in yoga. That's what they're all based in. But I think that we sometimes think that if we can give ourselves a bit of clarity and that moment of to respond rather than react, I think, yeah, that's my first tip.
Oh, excellent. Perfect. Now, I know at the minute, one of the hot topics, particularly during this global pandemic, and it's been very difficult for managers to adjust and for leaders to adjust to suddenly managing remote workforces. It's put strains on trying to manage existing workflows whilst leading teams. There's been a big element of trust that's been required to ensure people are working for, you know, in their home offices and bedrooms and sheds, wherever it might be, whereas before you were able to sort of manage them, you know, and be able to observe them more easily, I guess, in an office-based environment. So bearing in mind your knowledge and understanding that you have of neuroscience, how can we, going forward, both now whilst we're still in this pandemic, but also post-pandemic, how can we use your understanding of neuroscience to improve employee engagement and productivity for the future?
So, so engagement and motivation are very closely linked. And I think that now more than ever, a scenario that that I've heard before in the past is we need to understand which of our people, first of all, do we want to support and engage and motivate in our organizations. But actually, do we actually know what motivates our people? What are we having the dialogue, the conversations, to be able to turn around and say, yes, I understand your pressures. I understand your challenges right now. I understand actually. Because motivation, from a psychological perspective, I'm sure many of the listeners have maybe read Daniel Pink's Drive, but there's also the work that's built off the back of that by DC and Ryan around the autonomy, belonging, and competence, and those factors that we are motivated and driven by different situations at different times. And motivation is a massive topic, but I think if we can get into the bones of each of our team members and really understand, empathize, but understand what drives my my colleague and my subordinate, the person in my team, on is it autonomy? Do they need freedom? Do they need control? Do they need to be able to make their own choices? Do they miss the team scenario? Do they miss the belonging of the group, the togetherness, the connections that are made when we are face to face, and more so when we're not face to face? Actually, some people feel more belonging in this virtual space that we're in, this sort of expanded space where we are. But a lot of people are missing that connection, that belonging, that feel of connectivity. And also, the next thing, do I have the skills? Do I feel I have the skills to be able to deliver what I am asked to deliver on a day-to-day basis? Am I competent enough? Am I, and that's not just about skills, but that's about what's my journey in terms of learning in general? Where am I at? Because we know that in terms of, if we're looking generationally, there aren't enough positions. We can't, if you're viewing your progression up an organizational ladder just by promotions, then you're going to be disappointed because there aren't enough positions to attach to allow people to jump up a layer. But what we are looking at now in terms of more millennial Gen Y, I think, is about collecting skills, collecting capability, collecting experiences to be able to then help us to tackle our career longer term. And then the other big thing that we've missed out is purpose, the meaning. Why do I come to this role? Why do I come to this organization? Why do I come to this job? What drives me? So if leaders can get into that, those key areas, first of all, understand what makes this person tick, what makes this person move and move towards rather than moving away, I think that's a really key starting point. But a lot of individuals are a bit worried about having that conversation because they might uncover things that they don't really want to deal with or tackle.
Sure. And you also have to admit to yourself that you may be lacking some skills, and that can be difficult from an ego perspective. And just, you know, not all of us want to admit that we have a skill shortage somewhere, and you have to sort of then look inward to find those sometimes. But interestingly, some of the things you were talking about there, and talking about, you know, the Gen Y and the way that the employee experience has changed. So with that in mind, obviously we've moved a long way away, in my view, from how people used to lead teams in the past. It was probably a little bit more, you mentioned the book Drive, which I read some time ago, but I know he talks a lot about the old methods of motivation between carrot and stick in that book and how we've moved forward. How have you seen leadership change over, you know, since you've been studying the subject, I guess? And how would you describe the role of the modern leader, if that's the right term?
So I am a big advocate of servant leadership, which therefore is putting the team, the people who are your followers, at the focal point. You as a leader are not there to be the hero, the individual that comes in and saves the day. You're there to support, facilitate, and keyword, coach the individuals to be able to deliver what they're coming to work to deliver. So I think the command and control, the tell and do, unfortunately, I think it's still prevalent within organizations, not as much as where we have been, but I think it's still there because you get it. People under pressure, your livelihood, your job, your promotion, your bonus, whatever that's attached to this, then the people that are there to, under your control, dictate whether you achieve what you want to achieve as well. So people, when under pressure, and turn into this threat response in the brain rather than a toward response, and the threat response is under pressure, makes us a bit more narrow-minded, a little bit closed off to creative ideas, we tend to then jump on and micromanage. So I think where we're looking at that, we have transferred to more of a coaching leadership role. I very much believe that. But again, the organization's culture, the pressures that that individual faces, how often do they flip back to the tell and do and command and control? And culturally, in different countries, in different parts of the world, that can differ as well, because that's the way that the organization have done it forever, or that's their style. But I think that, for me, servant leadership, that putting your people at the heart of what you do, that you come to make sure that they are supported, that you're there to guide them, that you're not giving them the answers. I was given some great advice that probably most individuals in most organizations, in terms of leaders, do the job of the person below them. They feel that their life is you're under pressure to be able to deliver and justify your own existence and the results of your team. And therefore, we tend to go down a level rather than up a level or maintain at our level. So we're always trying to answer the problem, solve the problems, deliver the answers to the people below us. And therefore, productivity is massively reduced because that person's not being paid for what they're actually trying to do. They're being paid for the job below them. I'm not sure if you'd agree, but I think that's obvious at times.
I'm definitely in your camp. I think I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate. I agree with you, by the way. I think everything you've said is exactly the way that I would like to see myself as a leader and the way I think we need to lead going forward. I think the way that people lead has changed significantly. Certainly since I've been in recruitment over the last 20 years, I've seen a fundamental shift in the way that we engage our employees and the way that I've seen successful leaders rise to the top because of the way that they engage their employees. And I do think that they go hand in hand with promotion. The reasons people get promoted is because of the way that they're leading the people below them in the hierarchical structure sense of things. However, to play devil's advocate slightly, can we go too far one way? And I'll give an example. I'm a huge football fan, so I follow the Premier League, and there used to be a relationship within my lifetime where the management was in charge, and you know, you signed a contract with a club, for example, and you served that contract, and that was what happened. Whereas now, it's the amount of money in the game maybe a reason for this, but also you find the players have a lot more control now than the managers, and actually, if the players aren't happy with something, and in this instance, you can reference this as being the employee, if you like, they're able to actually influence change and cause management departures sometimes because they're not happy. And I think at the minute we're in a culture where certainly brands are really focused on retaining employees rather than attracting them. And that's been a shift in the recruitment space, which I know you've done recruitment as well, so you've probably seen that. Where now brands are really looking to engage employees, retain top talent, keep them happy, try and reduce attrition, and it's less about attraction. So with that in mind, can we go too far in one direction where it becomes too much about the employee at the risk of leadership, really, at the risk of that kind of structure?
Yeah, I think it was one of your previous guests, Richard Watkins, talking about collaboration, where I think a leader will automatically fall, and a leader will come to the fore anyway. And I don't think we can have these super flat structures where everybody has a say. But I think it's about using the information to be able to allow people to have a voice. I think people want to be directed at times. They want to be able to follow somebody, and they want to be at times told what to do. I don't think too much choice. There's that experiment. There's a bit of research around jams. I'm not sure if you heard of it, but if they did an experiment where a group of people had a choice of 6 jams to go for, or they had a choice of 24 jams to go for. And actually, what we found is that the confusion of having too many choices, too much control, too many options, therefore makes it very difficult to make a decision after all. So I do believe that there needs to be direction. Of course there is. I don't think everyone can completely be self-led and these self-led teams. But I believe there is a harmony. There is a halfway house, absolutely, where we can make sure that the leader still is driving the strategic, the objective, the vision, the goal. But I do believe that the teams can have a greater say if a leader is aware of, again, what triggers their motivation, what triggers best practice, from neuroscience anyway.
Sure. I think that plays in. I know that certainly empathy, I think, is probably more important now than it was in terms of a leadership quality in the past, certainly from my perspective. I'd like to, that's sort of one emotion that I connect with as I think as being an important one for leadership. Obviously, I know you'll know a lot more, and I don't know how, whether we should or shouldn't be labeling emotions, but what's your view then? I know that, so give some context to this. My mum actually is a doctor in baby development studies, so she does a lot of studies of the brain. I know that it's the amygdala that is the part of the brain that's associated with anxiety and avoidance behavior. What's your view as an expert in terms of how we, you know, should we be labeling emotions? Should we be, you know, how does the amygdala respond from a leadership context that would be useful for leaders listening to this to get a better understanding of?
Yeah, so I think a great book that I would recommend people to pick up is The Chimp Paradox by Professor Steve Peters. And he talks about, simplifies neuroscience in regards to how the brain is structured. So we've got the chimp, which is the limbic system, which includes the amygdala and that area that has the hypothalamus. And I won't go into too much detail, but that key region that looks after the emotional response, the first thing that tends to trigger or respond to the stimuli that we see. Then the other side of it is the human part of the brain, which is that thinking part. And I think that first bit of information, knowledge, for me, I mean, I know obviously the depth of it, but actually for somebody who's coming to new to neuroscience and understanding the emotional response, the chimp, as is described, is that first thing that either reacts or responds, reacts to negatively, and tends to be there to defend that individual, survive, and make that person survive. And I think by understanding that part of the brain, so you can, yes, label emotions, anger, sadness, frustration, I think that's fantastic, but actually going a bit deeper and actually labeling, okay, this is this part of the brain that's doing, and it's there because it's protecting me and it's looking after me and it's wanting me to survive, but actually is what I'm reacting to actually what I should be reacting to? And so we need to then get the thinking part, the more logical part of the brain, into gear, which where the breathing comes in and at the starting of our conversation. But it's understanding that there is a lot going on in our human brain. And that just talking about the amygdala or just talking about single emotions absolutely helps. But I think we need to be aware, okay, I'm feeling this, I'm understanding, but most of the time people don't recognize what's going on. Most of the time you've actually reacted, you've shouted at, responded to, sent back that email in frustration to a response that you feel has been overly curt or aggressive. And that's your chimp responding to that message, that email. But actually what we need to do very quickly is step back, get a bit of objectivity, get that thinking, prefrontal cortex, logical part on the go. So we can look at that email from a distance and go, actually, there's nothing in that. There is nothing in that. There's no emotive content in there that I need to think about or engage with. Actually, they're just asking for this information. But it's our chimp that's reacting to, oh, they think I'm not very good at this, or they're putting me under pressure because I need to do. So we start creating this sort of internal dialogue. So emotion, label emotions is great. Yes, I'm feeling angry. And it's known to help dissipate that emotional response. But I think we can go a bit bigger than that and actually recognize there is the brain is there to protect in the first instance, but is it protecting me for the right reasons, the right things?
Absolutely love that. I think I can certainly think of a few examples where my chimp in this context has jumped in, particularly with emails, because, you know, we can't read tone in an email. We can interpret tone, but our brain my brain certainly will create a response to an email that's come in, but I will add the tone to the words that I'm reading. And quite often the tone I give to those words will be the incorrect tone. And usually this happens when I think it's negative. If someone's challenging me, when I think it's unfair, suddenly I've added a voice to that message over to me, and I've created this thing in my head that probably was sent in complete innocence, but I've read it differently, I've interpreted it differently. And that, you know, it's funny how you channel so many different emotions in you when you read something. It's often incorrectly because you've added that tone to it. And I guess that kind of links to your breathing thing that you mentioned there, because, you know, I'm a big believer on, if I want to respond to an email that I've had that response to, I tend to sleep on it, which I guess is another way of breathing and taking a bit of a pause. And I will very rarely want to write the same response I wanted to write the following day. When I've had time to sleep on it, think on it and reflect and come back the following day, I always tend to read it differently. So is that kind of an example of what you were referring to?
That's great. It's giving yourself space ultimately to be able to think more logically rather than, I mean, let's be honest, the brain focuses on negative 5 times more than it focuses on positive. So the brain is constantly looking out for what we believe to be a very negative environment, or things are out to get us a lot. And that's pretty much seems to be solid in the research. So if we put that into perspective, we're constantly looking for things that are going to hurt us or affect us psychologically, physically. And actually what we need to recognize is if the brain is constantly doing that, we need to counter that by trying to get into a more objective and positive place to be able to then look at things and engage. Because as soon as we meet new people, we're constantly on the lookout to see, can I trust you? Are you a friend or are you a foe? Without even doing anything, are you with me or against me? We're viewing people as are they a threat? And I think that can be anything, new assignment, new project. If you're looking at it from a towards perspective, this is what I'm going to learn. This is a great new project. I'm going to learn this. We're going to meet new people. I'm going to build new relationships. It could potentially help with my career. Or most of the time people are going, but if I get it wrong, it's going to affect my career. If it doesn't go right, I'm going to affect some relationships. My boss is going to think less of me. We tend to, as humans, go on the negative side. So just by understanding that as a piece of information, we can then start thinking everything that I'm delivering to my team and my people, they're always going to look at it as in, how's it going to affect me? How's it going to affect me in a positive or negative way?
I never knew that. It's the first I've heard that we focus on negative 5 times more than we do on the positive. I've learned that today, and it does make sense. I'm certainly someone who, and I'm sure others are like me, because my wife's the same as I am, so there'll be others listening to it will be the same as this, but you start with something small that's an issue. And actually, this has probably happened in the pandemic, to be honest, where the media is really, you know, the amount of negativity that's been reported, and we all kind of focus on that. But I get one little bit of bad news, and if I don't have time to process it, that I create stories in my mind where suddenly then this could happen. And if that doesn't happen, then this happens, and then this happens. And by the time you've actually got to grip with what the original issue is, kind of dissipated. But in my head now, I've created a gigantuan problem that's had so many negative knock-on, probably 5 times worth of knock-on effects, because I've created this story in my mind of, if this doesn't happen, then all these knock-on things will happen. And they always seem to be negative. It's very rare that I do that with the positive mindset. Maybe I need to shift that around. I'd consider myself a very positive person, but I do know that sometimes if something negative happens, it's very easy to build that story and you build a narrative around it in your mind. And suddenly it becomes something that's much bigger than the original sum of its parts, if that makes
Definitely.
Sense.
Definitely. It's catastrophizing is the term in, if you're looking at cognitive behavioral therapy. And so what we're saying is, oh, I've just done a bad piece of work, or that candidate in a recruitment sense, that candidate isn't going to start. Therefore, the client's going to think that I'm not very good anymore. We're in a really tough environment. Therefore, they're going to go and look at another supplier. I've lost that client forever. I've lost that client means I'm going to lose other clients. That means that, therefore, my business is going to fold. I'm then going to lose my house. My wife's going to leave me. My kids. It continues. Do you know what I mean? You can just take. I mean, that's a massively extreme scenario. But we do that the same with lots of things. I mean, I'm not saying that everyone does that. There are lots of people who can very quickly flip that and reframe it, and very quickly look at, oh, a traffic jam actually isn't a traffic jam. We don't traffic jams don't exist anymore because we tend to all working from home. But if you're sat in a traffic jam, actually, it's an opportunity to maybe catch up with somebody else or listen to a podcast that you've not listened to before, rather than getting frustrated, annoyed about the situation you're in. Let's reframe it. Let's look at it from a different angle and look at it as if, okay, well, I can now go and give my mum a call because I've not spoken to her for ages and actually see how she's getting on.
Have you ever asked yourself, how can any recruiter understand my HR recruitment challenges? Please don't give up on your hiring challenges just yet. Here at JGA HR Recruitment, we appreciate the difficulties associated with attracting, recruiting and retaining top human resources talent. We also understand just how costly a poor hire can be. JGA HR Recruitment would like to partner with you to help you overcome your hiring challenges. Contact us today on 01727 800 377 or visit jgarecruitment.com to find out more.
Shaping the future of human resources together. Final questions.
So let's bring it back then to the behavioural science side of things. How can we use behavioural science then to really improve our leadership capabilities?
I think what I find leadership capabilities is understanding actually what are our strengths. So where are we coming from in terms of what are we great at? But I think that one of the things, particularly from a learning and development perspective, is that in the training that we're doing, I think what are the skills that are required moving forward? What are the skills that we need to survive, but also thrive in this now, hopefully post-pandemic phase? And I think that those soft skills are where it's at. In that now, leadership is about engaging, communicating, supporting, making connections with other people, and being resilient, being able to collaborate. Those key skills are now going to really come to the fore. And I think what we know from neuroscience, psychology, behavioral science, we can start putting some proper processes into place of how we can develop that and build on those skills. Because I think the IQ. Talent around IQ and intelligence, of course, we would love to have intelligent human beings, but ultimately, that's only a very small part of the puzzle now. And I think we talk about EI, emotional intelligence, has been a soft skill. Those are the things that make a leader the best leader they can possibly be. Everyone wants a leader who's competent. Everyone wants a leader who is intelligent, but really people want a leader who listens, who understands, who shows empathy, who is resilient themselves under stressful times, who can communicate their message in the right way, who can build great teams and collaborate with great teams, can manage conflict when it arises at the time as well. So for me, by using the neuroscience, you can just understand what's going on in the brain and other people's brains to be able to then maybe hit that mark where we haven't before.
You've definitely described what I would term as being an ideal leader in that summary. But you talked a lot about resilience. I think you mentioned it a couple of times as being a real core skill and something that's very, very important within a leadership framework. So it's obviously, I want to stay on that resilient subject just for a moment, because for me personally, I know for many people listening to this podcast, that COVID-19, the coronavirus, has had a real impact on everybody, particularly in relationship to resilience. So how have you seen it impact in relation to the coronavirus? How have you seen it really impact on leadership resilience from an expert point of view?
So I'll talk from a personal perspective. I think without knowing what I know about resilience, and I think let's start off. Resilience is just a word. What do people understand what a resilient person looks like? What are the behaviors of a resilient person? And resilience is too often for me, it's talked about bouncing back to the state that they were before. Well, actually, that isn't necessarily resilience as I see it. Resilience is not just bouncing back, but learning and growing from that experience and learning and using that experience to be better within either that same situation or using it again in the future. So let's not just use it about bouncing back, let's move forward. And then I think the other factor is that resilience isn't just about going to the gym as a blow off to be able to use exercise. I'm resilient because I exercise. Resilient is made up of, and we use a grounded psychological model that's valid and reliable that actually measures resilience. And there are core components in that, which is around your meaning and your purpose, your mindset. Are you an optimist or a pessimist? Do you have supportive relationships? How do you problem solve? What is your emotional regulation, emotional intelligence strategies, and what are your physiological practices? So whether that's exercise, meditation, mindfulness. So when I talk about resilience and in our workshops and the training that we do, we really break it down into a clear plan of where this person is in terms of their strengths when it comes to resilience, but also where are the development areas? What can we do to improve? Because I think you and I had the conversation last week, if you go to the gym consistently or you use exercise as your only outlet to be able to be resilient in times of stress, what happens if you pull a muscle, break a leg, hurt yourself, injure yourself, and you can't do that exercise moving forward? That's going to make you even less resilient because you're relying on just one leg or one part of what I see as a much bigger model or a much bigger factor. So I think resilience is the long-term impact of someone being resilient means that they're going to come to work, and if they have a bad day, that isn't going to then affect their relationships, their productivity. The long term, they will look at it, reframe it, change it, do whatever they need to do within their resilient model, and then come back the next day ready to go again. So I think that the resilience right now is a huge asset to have if you know how to be resilient. And I love the top. I love the concept and the different components that make up resilience because it's needed right now. Gosh, yeah.
Sure. I definitely agree. It's definitely needed right now, and it's going to be needed going forward as we start to slowly return to work and hopefully return to work. Obviously, going to be a lot of people that are going to be struggling as a result of this pandemic as well. You mentioned that the physiological side of things a little bit in that response as well. I wonder if there are any, short-term fixes. If I need to gain some, I say, maybe I'm using resilience then in the wrong context here, but I need a little bit more strength. I need a little bit more resilience for a particular meeting that's coming up. I'm panicked about a conversation I've got or a meeting, and I want to give myself the best opportunity to perform well. I've read some studies around things like glucose having an effect, and you know, you mentioned breathing already. Are there any tips you could give the listeners about, you know, how we can really help prepare ourselves for something that might be giving us some anxiety?
Yeah. So the anxiety, where's it coming from? What's the anxiety? There's a technique that I use, which is, again, is based in cognitive behavioral coaching therapy, which is called the ABC. I'm not going to go into that now, but I think if people want to go away and have a look at the ABC model in terms of how do we tackle some of our negative thoughts, and it's about, actually, it's not the events that make us anxious, it's our thoughts that make us anxious. So I would advise people, we aren't probably don't have time to go into it now, to go and have a look at that. But one of the things that I would say is,
I'll try and find a link and put it in the episode notes for those interested.
Do. Yeah, do. But it's something that we do cover in our courses as well, because it's a massively powerful tool. But actually, what we're seeing right now is people are bouncing from one Zoom call or one Zoom meeting to another. And we do the same in our organization as well. We're bouncing around from one place to the next. And what the brain cannot do is, first of all, we're not great at multitasking. We know that. We're switched tasks. So we tend to go from one task to another task. We can't really compute and manage two different things at the same time. The brain is just bouncing between the two separate entities. And therefore, what we need to do is when we have had that meeting, when we've had that session, have we gathered the information, logged it, collated it, notes wherever they are, put it to one side and leave that to one side, then give yourself some space, a space to be able to either think of something else, breathe, go for a walk, get some water, hydrate, whatever it may be. But I think that the anxiety, the stress comes from overload. With that cognitive overload, be that competing commitments, be that challenges of guilt around not spending enough time with my kids or whatever it may be. There's lots of stuff that's going on there. But I think that we've got to give ourselves, break it down into components of this is this meeting. And it's very hard because things bleed into each other. But I think if we're very clear, and particularly as a coach as well, if I'm going from session to session to session, you're giving yourself no time to recuperate and recover from whatever you're putting yourself through in that. And the brain depletes super quickly, particularly if you're having to think hard about something that's quite complicated and quite challenging, or it's a challenging conversation with a colleague or with one of your team members. So we need to understand that the brain is like a battery. It does absolutely deplete, particularly that more logical and thinking part of the brain. So how are we going to boost that? I wouldn't advise the caffeine. I wouldn't advise the going and getting a Mars bar. Sugar hits great for a little bit, but let's think more about the holistic well-being route of maybe some nuts or a bit of fruit or something that's going to give you a more balanced release of sugar, glucose into the system. But my advice is very much right now, if I'm not running from a Zoom call to doing a coaching session, to checking if the kids are doing their homework or whatever it may be, you just then get sucked into this constant whirlwind of task and completing stuff. Try and give yourself that little bit of space. And even if it's just sat for a minute, 2 minutes, at least you're then gathering your thoughts to be able to put it to one side, come back to it later on, and then give yourself your full attention. Because attention is limited as it is right now. And if attention if we can't focus on that individual or that task, then we're not going to complete it to the best of our ability.
Sure. Although you have just described exactly what I do, which is grab a coffee and a Mars bar. And you know what? A Mars bar is exactly what I have. My mum told me years ago, before every exam, have a Mars bar. I don't know why, it's just stuck with me. So I always do. If I'm struggling, you literally just described exactly the course I do take, which isn't fruit. I grab a coffee, I grab a Mars bar, I take that time to eat it, to kind of take the breathing space I need, and then I go in. But maybe I'll try and readjust that to something slightly more healthy. But I know, you know, is there more science you could give us regarding how glucose affects the brain and how that works and how that can support us, albeit probably from a better source than I'm getting it from at the moment?
So again, I'm not a sort of a nutritional specialist, but I think what we know is that the brain is so energy hungry that it saps, it's when we come to the end of the day and we think, I've not really done anything today, or I'm not. The exercise, tiredness from an exercise perspective and fatigue from being out in the garden or doing some sort of physical work is so completely different to that that mental fatigue, that cognitive fatigue that we have. And we know that from headaches and from the challenges that we can't sleep because our minds constantly worrying. But I think that the glucose is to keep the brain topped up to the right level to make sure that, because again, if we then have glucose spikes, then we have caffeine spikes, again, we may feel like we're on fire, but actually we may be talking way too quickly. We may be not being able to actually focus our attention properly. So I think there are experts out there who can tell you much more about how glucose affects the brain. But what we do know is when we're depleted, we've skipped lunch, we've skipped drinking any water during the day. We've not maybe had a stretch or a rest or a break from what we're doing. We know that the brain then is in the red lines on the battery zone, and we're not going to perform as well.
Sure. No, I think that's fair. So let's bring it back then to healthy workplace relationships. I still want to leave it on you know, talking about brain. I find it fascinating. So how can healthy working relationships stimulate and motivate our brains? You know, why should we really be focused on improving the healthy workspace to help with things like motivation? And what can we do to try and achieve that?
Relationships, I think, again, Richard Watkins talked about, we've lived in and survived in groups forever. So we need groups to allow our continued success. But then we also want our own individual perspective in that group. So we need groups to survive. And if we're not part of that group, we know that the brain feels social exclusion, that social pain, in the very similar part as we feel physical pain. So if you're punched in the arm or you hurt yourself, the pain receptors are not in a dissimilar region to them being not invited to that party or not invited to that meeting or not invited to take part in a project. So I think first and foremost, we're social animals, and we react very keenly to our social interactions and our social environments. And that's what something that I would focus on and think about if you're a leader, is that people want to be part of a group. They get their energy from a group, and that there are certain things that affect us, whether it's fairness, whether it's certainty, whether it is, whether it might be autonomy. There's lots of things that may affect, actually, do I feel part of that group? And connections is where it's at. But then on the other hand, we've got to realize that people are individuals and they want to be on their own and they want to be treated as an individual as well. So it's a really key skill to be able to balance bringing people together and understanding what makes groups work, but on the other side, looking at what individuals require on an individual basis. And we work with teams regularly, and I think the key factor when we're looking at psychological safety, which I'm sure is a term you've heard of a lot, allowing people to feel that they can communicate and voice their opinions, their thoughts, without being cut out of the group, or that they're not going to be laughed at or seen as being it's a silly idea. Right now, we need everyone's input. We need as much cognitive diversity. We need as much input as possible to help us see the answers to the problems that are being faced right now. And so being very clear on and creating an environment, a psychologically safe environment where my people can say what they want to say is hugely, hugely important. But again, that is the leader's role, in that is to recognize their own challenges, to say, actually, do I maybe jump in and want to just lead the way? Do I want to drive the agenda, the strategy, the goals? I want to drive every conversation. Or do I actually need to zip my mouth for a bit, sit back and listen to the input from the people that are there? They'll then say, well, it takes too long. It takes too long to get people to take their input and listen to everyone's voice. But again, you're missing the point that everyone's voice needs to be heard to be able to have that engagement and to have that involvement in where that team or that organization is heading. So I think it's the leaders of organizations and smaller teams just need to think about, actually, how do I interact with these groups? I know that that we feel social pain. I know that there's us versus them, and that if I'm in this in-group, out-group scenario, then that affects people's motivation and productivity. So it's tapping into all this research around neuroscience and psychology, I think, really, really helps leaders understand what's going to make our people perform and themselves perform.
So you've articulated that brilliantly. And of course, it makes sense now to talk a little bit, I guess, about Phoenix Leaders and what you do. You specialize in training business leaders in L&D, in human resources. You talk about communication and help with things like creativity. And obviously, we've talked a lot today about, you know, leaders of the future need to be more emotionally aware. That we know, you know, in the world today, we need to be able to communicate across different generations, different cultures and different processes, either be it remote or face to face now, which has been a big rapid change recently. And obviously, we've got different types of workforces, from Gen Z to baby boomers. So as part of the Phoenix leadership business, Simon, I wonder if you could just talk to me about some of the key work you've been delivering from an HR and L&D perspective, the kind of projects that you've been getting involved in. And if someone's listening to this and says, you know what, I love what Simon's had to say. I've really enjoyed his view on leadership and the importance neuroscience has to play in how we can become better leaders. And they go, I want to get in touch. You know, what kind of work are you doing at the moment? And tell us a little bit more about the work that you're doing with Phoenix Leaders.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, talking to an L&D HR community, I think I come from this angle as, first of all, we need the people that go through a learning journey to be able to do and implement the skills, the tasks, the intervention. They need to be able to input that into their working day. And I think that we use, even in terms of structuring programs or individual workshops, be those open workshops where lots of people come together, or that they're directed just to an organization, that we use a neuroscience model of learning and how the brain learns, so that now I'm struggling with organizations, learning providers who are giving workshops over a full day, 9 to 5, online in a virtual environment. The brain cannot handle, human beings cannot handle that sort of information overload or information transfer. And so therefore, if individuals are going to these courses and therefore not the brain's fizzled out after 45 minutes, actually, what's the rest of that time? What's being spent? What are they actually doing? So therefore, the point of going to that course is, well, I'm not remembered half of it. I'm not going to use it. So we very much set out and set up our courses, our programs, to make sure that the learner is at the heart of what we do, but we also make sure that the learning sticks and that we build attention, engagement at the start, and that the event itself isn't the superstar or the hero of this. The event is something where we can get together and engage with ideas and show a bit of theory, but a lot of practice. But that's only part of the journey. We've got to make sure that we're getting the buy-in from the individual, and therefore our coaching sessions work afterwards to enhance that and embed that learning. And why getting, when we're doing leadership development programs, getting organizations and line managers involved in the person, the learner, going on this journey, so that we're, again, getting some sort of social conformity, making sure that everyone's bought into it. Because too often people go to a learning event and what's the research shows, they probably 15% take that information and go and run with it and use it. Probably 70% go to an event, use the information for a bit, and then go backslide into where they were, and 15% just don't engage with it at all. And that's a massive amount, that's a huge amount of investment that maybe isn't. So we try and make sure that we really use the neuroscience to understand how does the adult brain learn, make sure that the information, the content is designed around the learner, and that it sticks. And so, again, with grabbing the attention, setting the context, making sure that the learner understands what they're going to get from this and why it's going to work, the event itself, follow up in terms of information, assignments, coaching, whatever it looks like, and then also buy-in from the organization to make sure that these skills are being consistently used, I think is vital. Because what's the return on investment? Budgets are tight and are going to be, particularly within learning development, at times that can sometimes be the first thing to go in this current climate. I don't think it should be. I think it should be boosted and bolstered even further. But if as an external supplier, as a training provider, we've got to show return on investment and added value. And so I think that gone are the days, I'll be interested to take people's thoughts, and if they want to gain touch and have a chat about this, gone are the days of these 5-day programs back to back. I'm not sure if they actually do what they say they're going to do. I'm not sure that a 2-day course back to back, actually people are going to remember where it's at. I don't think there's enough space in between necessarily. Or how can we space these interventions to make sure that the learning does stick? Because we know that sleep really helps. So having a break in between a piece of information allows people to. So we work with individuals who want to come in and expand their knowledge. We work with organizations, with a team of people who want, let's talk about resilience, let's talk about conflict management. And then we do full leadership programs where we have a number of, spread over maybe 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, 12 months, to be able to take a group of people through a journey. It'd be that emerging leaders right the way through to expert leaders.
Amazing. Fantastic. And I think what's really lovely as well is, of course, you're delivering that very much from an L&D and HR background in this sector as well. So you've got a real knowledge of the market itself and the people that you're dealing with, which I think is really, really important to have that experience to give you that little bit of an edge, if you like. And funnily enough, to bring it full circle, I actually read a recent article that you wrote, and it was back in February 2020, that was published in HR Review magazine, which was all about achieving a well-rounded employee well-being strategy. And I just want to, I guess, finish really with, it's such a hot topic at the minute within the HR communities, of how can we achieve a more well-rounded employee strategy. So without giving the whole article away, because I will put a link in the episode notes so people can find it themselves, along with your contact information, which you mentioned in your last answer, to if people want to reach out to yourself or Phoenix leaders, they can do so. But I wonder if you could just finish with a couple of tips to the HR professionals listening to this about how they could go about achieving a more well-rounded employee strategy.
So this is an employee well-being strategy. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So I think the key factor is we need to get the top team involved. That's the first thing. I think that for the things that have happened in this pandemic, a lot of good that will come out of it is around mental health, mental well-being, and well-being of people in general. And I really hope that this momentum continues to show how mental health, well-being affect the bottom line and productivity. But I think the first starting point is having a very well-defined, structured program, but is very much bought in by the stakeholders and is communicated by the senior stakeholders in the organization. Because without that, it can feel a little empty. And that's the same for any intervention or anything. But I think that we've got people at the senior level of the organization living this and talking about it and communicating it, I think is the first bit. But I also think that we need to look at it in the round. So it's not just mental health, and let's not just focus on mental health, but let's focus on well-being as a whole. So whether it's that's around the diet, the actual environment that we're working in, what does that look like now in terms of people working from home? How do we make sure that people working from home 2-3 days a week, that looks like that might be the norm moving forward. How do we make sure that they were maintaining and managing and understanding from a holistic perspective how they're getting on in terms of well-being? But again, it goes back to the managers. It goes back to the managers really knowing your people and understanding actually those managers, those people they report to, are they clear on what well-being looks like for themselves and then for the team? Because I always talk around putting your own mask on first. So if you're going to lead a group of people, and let's talk about you're on an airplane, first thing you do when the mask drops down, you're told, put yours on first before you put it on anybody else, whether it's your kids. And that's the same with leadership. If you've got to be in control of the knowledge, the information, to be able to look after you before you can then go and start engaging and helping others.
I think you've put that brilliantly. I think that's a great way to finish as well. It's been a real educational journey through neuroscience and through leadership qualities. And thank you so much for joining me today, Simon Ashton, Head of Learning and Development at Phoenix Leaders. Of course, if you want to find out more, I will put links in the episode notes, or you can go to phoenixleaders.co.uk for more information as well. Again, that link will also be in the episode notes. Of course, if you are interested in finding an expert HR or L&D professional for your business, and you want to work with a recruitment expert that isn't Simon, because his background is also in search, but he's come out of that now, then please do give myself a call, Nick Day at JGA Recruitment, on 01727 800 377, or you can email me at nick@jgarecruitment.com. I should ask you, Simon, actually, before I lose you, you obviously do have a background in search. What is it that took you away from the world of recruitment?
I really enjoy my time in recruitment, but I think that this thirst for knowledge to go and find out again why do human beings do what they do. I wanted to get to is there a root cause, is there a thing, and what I found, there isn't one root cause. So I've really opened up Pandora's box in my own head. But actually, recruitment was a really great way of engaging with lots of amazing people. But I actually have lots of ex-colleagues and friends still in the recruitment sector, and I wish them well right now, which can be quite a tough time. But it's that human behavior factor that really drove me to go and search out what else is out there. I've got to say, is that I love my my days. I love speaking to people, like-minded people, and thanks Nick, thanks for taking the time to speak to me today. I really appreciated it.
Absolute pleasure. I think it was a good move for you because I've really enjoyed the call. You're clearly incredibly passionate about the subject. I think it's been a really, really great episode today, and I hope everyone of my listeners has enjoyed the content you've given. So thank you ever so much again for joining me today. My name is Nick Day, of course. This is the HRL&D podcast, and I look forward to bringing you the next guest again in a couple of weeks. But if you have a moment today, please do take the time to review and subscribe to this podcast, and please share it as much as you can with any of your HRL&D colleagues to get the message out there. And I look forward to speaking to you all again real soon. Take care of yourselves and each other. Many thanks.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the HRL&D podcast with your host, Nick Day, CEO of JGA Recruitment Specialist HR Recruiters. If you need any help with the current HR or L&D vacancy, then please get in touch with Nick and his team. All contact details can be found in the episode notes. In the meantime, to make sure you never miss a future episode, please subscribe to the show through any of your favourite podcast channels. Till next time.